So I will gently try to continue now. Before we open up now our panel here, and we hopefully bring you together into a conversation, that's what we are hoping for. So it's not so much what we both will do, trying to ask questions to you, but bring you four now into a conversation and opening it up then to the audience. But before we do so, I would like to say again thank you for Uli Filsmeier to be with me here now on the panel, and shortly introduce you as my co-moderator here, because you're not coming now from the narrow field of art, but you are into inter- and transdisciplinary research, which is in our case also very important, very interesting. So I'm very much looking forward to your input and co-moderating with us this panel. So thank you very much, and also welcome. So, and I will lead the word first to you, so to have us a first, because it's always, I guess, as it was an intense day, and it would have been really nice to digest it, I totally agree. But yeah, we have, it's always part of an infrastructure also problem that you are kind of put into a frame and then you have to find a way to deal with it. So that's part of the deal, I guess. So I thought it would be nice to start with one first question. Perhaps you have one question, and then I will try also to bring you to discuss with each other, hopefully, and then we open up.
Yeah, many thanks. I would like to get back to two notions that were coined in the morning. Participatory art as a promise, but likewise a risk. And during the afternoon session, I really struggled to find out what are the notions that we really need to talk about the unforeseen in participatory arts or in arts that go beyond conventional formats, particularly when you told us that you wouldn't care about it. So could we probably in the first round find out what do we need to talk to each other about the question the organizers raise?
Yeah, well, I try to address the problem of the unforeseen through escalation and the risks of escalation. That that art could initiate actions. I was thinking of Bruguera very, very specifically, that she could initiate actions within the space of art, which could have devastating consequences outside. And I was then placing that kind of implicitly placing that beside her call for an East ethics. So looking at a tension between escalating, in which, fuck the police, don't worry about the consequences, but also put that in, what happens when you need to be responsible or ethically responsible for any of the destruction or the death, that could emerge from, that posture.
Well, I think in our organizing, we deal with that in very concrete ways. I think it's also about having your finger on the pulse. And if you look at what's happening in Chile and Haiti and Colombia and what's happening in Gaza, you recognize that this moment is very similar to May 68, right? And so part of what's, or situationist, or, you have to think in that way in which, as artists, I mean, artist is not a class. I mean, I think that people forget that, what is your material class as an artist, right? So thinking about that, what we tell people in this moment often is just like, oh, you have a march. Okay, how can you have a diversity of tactics? How can there be different modes of entry? Because this is not relating to one person. This is how do you facilitate spaces of empowerment. You can't empower. Gayatri Spivak tells us that. The notion of empowering anyone is bullshit. But how can you facilitate spaces of empowerment in which you must confront power? And I think artists don't really understand how power functions, right? But they like to be close to it and critique it.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I just wanted to bring the idea of art being a sanctuary space, and especially I think it's important. And I mean, the multiple there's sanctuary movements, and there's you know strong sanctuary movements around detention centers, but also like I think like how can we think of art institutions as sanctuary spaces? And then couple that with you know what's Fred Moten and Stefan Roharny in the Undercommons. How can these institutions and also then think of their resources and power and decenter that outside of it and see where it actually makes sense for them to be used. And so I think, for me, I think that's important. And then, you know, we're talking about Hong Kong, but also this moment. I think this moment is also not about civil disobedience, right? And once again, bringing Gayatri Law is not justice, or you know, all of these things. And so how can we then think of the movements that we create like being outside of that? So the idea is not that you get arrested, right? The idea is then how can you flow into the city? And you can move in autonomous zones and like all of these things. And so I think, and then yeah, so.
Okay, I'm going to fall back in my philosophical mode and take inspiration from Marx's Feuerbach thesis, where he says, you know, the philosophers have only interpreted the world, aber es kommt drauf an, das zu verändern, you know, but the point is to change it. Now, I'd like to turn Marx on his head. And I think that, of course, it's very important to act, given the urgency and the kind of problems of planetary ruin and destruction that we are facing, that you can't just, you know, sit there and reflect and contemplate. However, having said that, I think it is precisely in the face of urgency important to take a moment to think also, not about the consequences, not about how we can, in a certain way, make the unforeseen more predictable, more grappable, but rather to be very, very vigilant and careful about how in trying to find solutions, we might in unexpected ways perpetuate the problem. And I think that it is extremely, extremely urgent to take this time for slow thinking. I mean, Gramsci has this wonderful line where he says, the class which takes the longest to develop are the intellectuals. He says, all other groups evolve quite quickly. But because thinking is such a slow process, and that's the distinction perhaps between say, journalism and philosophical writing. And I can understand the anger against theory because theory can be very, very self-indulgent. It can be really intellectual masturbation, and believe me, I have nothing against masturbation. I think autoeroticism is very important, but it can be very, very self-indulgent. So I understand this impatience with theory and with philosophers, but I do think Hegel was onto something when he talks about the Owl of Minerva and says that philosophy can't be prescriptive. It can't tell you where to go and what to do because we can only in retrospect, in a certain way, understand the consequences of our actions. And which is, I mean, the self-reflection and contemplative part is not to, in a way, better predict our actions, but, I mean, to go back to this, and I'll stop here, go back to this metaphor of pharmacon of poison and counterpoison, that in trying to look for medicine, we don't, in a certain way, escalate the effects of the poison.
So one question back from my side. Yeah. This sounds to me as if you would argue for keeping plurality in the ways of approaching the world, of knowing, to create spaces where philosophers like you represent, activists, and probably more conventional form of artists would, in working together, pursue or achieve these different needs. Am I over interpreting you?
Mm-hmm. I use the term plurality, but it's not my favorite term. I would prefer the term singularity. And how can we, while we're doing global activism and trying to pursue global ethics, be sensitive to the singularity of different contexts? One response, and the other question would be, again, Marx, Feuerbach's thesis, who will educate the educator? While we're trying to transform the world and intervene and make it into a better place, fairer place, more just place, less violent, less exclusionary, how can we as transnational elites, and I'm interpolating a we in this room, we are transnational, we're not subalterns in this room, let that be very clear, how we, while responding to this imperative to decolonize, because it is an imperative, yeah, decolonize this space, exclamation mark, how this imperative, how in trying to respond to this question, what is to be done in order to decolonize, what do we do, and now here I'm totally plagiarizing from Derrida and Lenin, what do we do with the question, what is to be done? And how do we remain open to, maybe I'll use the word, plural answers, different answers, without presuming to already know what the answer is to this question?
Could be, sorry, but just could be this also perhaps the point where, you know, what we try to do, that we try to bring also you as different voices to get, like, that's exactly in a way what I hope we are trying to do, to bring you all as different voices together, trying to find ways to talk with each other, but a liberty not, you know, you don't have to copy each other. This is one question, but is it not also a problem of searching for methods and tools, because like how to continue, how to proceed in this kind of conversation?
I mean, we've had a lot of conversations with Gayatri Spivak as one of our mentors. So in terms of what we're thinking about here, what you're looking at, what we described here is training in the practice of freedom, right? So the notion of training in the practice, we don't know how to be free, but also freedom doesn't mean the same thing for each of us. And I think that we can be in this room together and okay, none of us are subaltern, but we could be each other's class enemy. And I think the recognition of these positionalities in this room is important. And I think we're at a moment in which we shouldn't emphasize unity as much as togetherness and to recognize difference in positionality. Because I think the idea of can the subaltern speak is about recognition of something, not so much, right? So, but it's also not about being impatient. I think somehow, and I mean, I'm trained in philosophy and it's something that I've also done, but it's not about being impatient and it's not about not thinking. But it is about, there's certain problems right now in which we conflate, for example, I'm sensitized to this, post-coloniality, which I don't think exists, with decolonization. Decolonization is very context specific. I think when we're talking about these struggles, let's say black liberation, indigenous struggle, we're talking about specificity of struggles in which we're trying to bring together because we recognize collective liberation. It doesn't happen with one group or the other. But also, class isn't the only foundational thing to build these kind of relations of power. If today we were free, and I think that decolonization in the 60s and 70s taught that, it's not like you all of a sudden, you know how to be free, right? You still, in the Palestinian context, you have Palestinians oppressing you. They look like you. In the context of the United States, you have Jay-Z. Black capitalism isn't the solution. But yet people are dying. So the idea of patience is also almost a theoretical concept. What happens when someone in self-defense does X? I mean, that was what Fanon was talking about, and I think Gayatri also mentioned that, right? So I think, like, from my perspective, it's not about us agreeing. It's about, in thinking about action, thinking about it in the broadest sense. Gramsci said, you know, the organic intellectual, but what does an intellectual mean to be engaged with their own reality? What does it mean for each of us in this room to recognize that we're an oppressor and oppressed? Who are the communities that we're accountable to? I think that's a really important. I'll tell you, I teach at NYU. I'm a facilitator of most of my students taking on student debt. Then I lecture about freedom. Well, fuck me and my and talking about freedom. I mean, if not freedom is about time, right? If I don't have time, if I don't have space, I'm not free. So then what does it mean to think about freedom in that context, and how am I responsible to my students? I mean, everything we're talking about is very specific in this institution at this table. Perhaps we shouldn't have had a conference altogether. Maybe there was a different way of thinking about this.
I wonder if I could just maybe divert the discussion a little bit. I come from a country that has a powerful activism now of the right, a very militant activism using many of the tactics that you employ, but from the right. They would be very happy to, they would say what we are doing is decolonizing our space, from the European colonizer. They would be very happy to speak of emancipation and freedom, they do, from the European Union. Now, I'm wondering kind of how far our conceptuality or our rhetoric of decolonization is immune to that kind of application or that kind of exploitation, or whether it is just a tactic that anybody can pick up and work with. Is decolonization always going to be in the interests of what I might regard as emancipation? That is, emancipation from the standpoint of the left, or can it also be from the right? I mean, because the Brexit people in the United Kingdom believe that they are, that theirs is a project of emancipation. They're very sincere, I think, as well, that they are prepared to use any means up to violence to achieve it. But it's not what I think of as decolonization or freedom or emancipation. Could you help me out with that?
I just would like to also to open then afterwards to the audience, but. Yeah.
Oh, I would just going to quickly say, I mean, I come from India and it's the same thing, right? And so we have Hindu fascists being that's, decolonization. And also basically, if you see the media and all these performances of holding Trump's hand or all these images coming out of being in coalition with UAE. Yeah. And so, I mean, I think there is that decolonization, which is the idea of being not Western, which doesn't necessarily mean that it's decolonization. And I think that's important. Yeah. And I mean, we know this, a lot of work, specifically writings from Latin America, but also I think North America. That's why I think what decolonization looks like today is not from the ones that we know from, let's say, Fanon or even from the Indian freedom struggle. It is a mix of things that are happening right now. And so I mean, when I think about Europe, I think of Gurminder Bhamra's work around decolonization, what that means with the refugee crisis here, but also all of that. So I think that's where, I think Amin already said it's context specific. And I think the way we think about it is that it doesn't differentiate between knowledges and practice, and that it's both, right? So it's not that it's just the doing or it's just the thinking, that there's both part of the act or the thinking or, and going with that. And so, and then the other thing is, I think that especially doing the work around the Whitney, when we are talking about Palestine, we're also talking about Puerto Rico and we're also talking about Kashmir. So these are I think that, how do you keep moving so that what you're talking about also does not get co-opted, because that's the best tactic. Specifically with the Whitney actions, once Warren Canders resigned, he left, there is a Puerto Rican council member in New York City who co-opted that way of doing actions, went to the MoMA, because there is a board member who is, investing in Puerto Rico, the federal debt, and all of that, and employed this exact same tactics. But at the same time, because the coalition exists, we were able to point that out and to actually act in our own ways that we want to. So I think that it's important. I mean, right now, there's action happening everywhere. I mean, to me, for example, Extinction Rebellion, I don't know, there's so many open letters by this group called Wretched of the Earth around that, there is a missing analysis of coloniality and what that means. And I think specifically thinking about climate change, once again, I think the problem is that people think that these issues are separate, right? Then being like, okay, they're connected. So that's why I think I also wanted to mention the centrality of land, water, and air to decolonization. So it's not just decolonization of the mind or the pedagogy, but it is of all our senses, right? Yeah. It is like of aesthetics. It's a way of being in the world. It's a way of feeling. And so when we do our actions, it's also not just... Again, we're not just trying to say, let's be going to this institution. It's also how are we living in this world? And how can we create little spaces for ourselves?
I mean, I agree with you, but you know, I wonder whether we're not being selective in our resistances or our defiances. I mean, would you be happy for kind of the right to use your stickers? I mean, are you neutral, ethically neutral? So, you know, the fascists can use your decolonize this space stickers.
I don't think they can, to be honest.
I don't think they have any trouble.
But I think on this point, it's just like, if the question is, can something be co-opted, then most certainly anything can. Right? So I don't know why the specificity around decolonization. If the name is a problem, we don't go around to communities that we work with, decolonize or not. It's a practice. You cannot name it that. I think what we're resistant to is these campaigns that are issue silos, where I can have a white person tell me about climate change, and he's like, the climate is, we're gonna all die. I'm like, no, 50% of the population is gonna die. That's where they're shutting down borders. Oh, sovereignty. No, sovereignty for some states matters, for others it doesn't. And borders are there to stop bodies, not to stop capital. So all of these things, we're not in the same position. Just like people were telling us about Whitney, it's better to have the Whitney than not to have the Whitney. I'm like, for who? For who? Because that Whitney is whitewashing, art washing, legitimizing the killing of my people. And I don't have the same stakes in that institution as you do. The construction of a we is in process. The strands are about what a we is. When we did Occupy Wall Street, we came up with the slogan 99%. David Graeber, me, a bunch of us, we were 50 people in emails back and forth, 500 emails. Because we said, you know, a common enemy, we don't have anything, but we can take a park, and in the park we can kind of open up space and many ideas can emerge. Same problem. Then you have the fascists come, and you have to figure out how to remove them. And then, all of a sudden, racial justice is not central. Stolen land is not central. And you wonder why the movement becomes white, and slowly Bernie Sanders, that's their platform. And then Elizabeth Warren today says that Israel has a right to bomb the Palestinians in Gaza. So I'm not going to throw down for that kind of struggle. I'm just not going to do it. And I think that this is what we're saying in New York. This is what we're saying. We're saying these struggles need to be led by those most impacted. And we follow. But it's also not an issue silo. So when we look at the fuck the police, it's because the police they put 1,000 cops in the subway. And they're hitting 14, 15-year-olds, and they pulled out guns on them.
I would like to have others as well talking. So because I know you are like... I wanted to bring a bit back also the point we had from the first panel, which... is also what frames what we are doing here. And it is also connecting to your work, because, I mean, at the end of the day, you also mentioned as one of the influential people in contemporary art world, I mean, as a matter of fact. So there is always this both sides that, you know, you don't care about art, but in the same time, your work is perceived as art. So, I mean, there is this kind of ambiguous situation. And when because I really would like to go also to open up to the audience and to connect to what we heard in the morning. So yes, please, Monica.
Yeah, I just feel tempted to intervene in this exchange that was going on about, you know, how the right co-opts certain slogans, certain kinds of rhetoric, and then which can often tend to blur the differences and can tend to be the response. They're both extremists, you know, and they're both... I think one very important difference, even if I mean, there's a long history of rhetoric being co-opted from different directions. I think one very important difference about the ways in which the same words, the same rhetoric is being used is all these right-wing populist movements, whether it's Modi in India or it's the Brexit or it's Trump or whatever, they all rest on the premise of certain ways of creating a national we. You know, describing the narratives about who belongs to this national we. And it's always the national. And I think today, those of us who are thinking of decolonization in different ways don't use the nation as a unit any longer. And I think there's a long history of also kind of, you know, solidarity across national boundaries. And I think this is changing very fast. If we think about the changing cartographies in which we work, I mean, I'm a scholar more than an activist, though I've been involved with the feminist movement in India for many years before I came to Europe. But I think, you know, the cartographies are changing very fast. So today, we don't think in terms of Cold War cartographies, East and West. We no longer, even the West and the rest has kind of lost some of its meaning and its sharpened edge. Even the global North and the global South today has got dissolved because of the refugee crisis. In the middle of the Western world, you know, we have the so-called other, which is part of the we, if you like. So I think there is a major difference, and that's why, you know, one of the terms I used in the morning was this new way of developing transregional affinities. And I think that would be one way of distinguishing between the way different people use the term decolonize. So.
I'd just like to add something very briefly at the risk of playing the devil's advocate. But, I mean, of course, we should be worried about the right and the co-option of, you know, strategies and tactics and vocabulary. But at this moment, I had to think about Hannah Arendt, who says it's not what the personal problem was not what our enemies did, but what our friends did. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about solidarities and we're talking about the emancipatory, progressive we, we have to be very, very, again, I keep coming up with this vocabulary. I almost sound like a grandmother who keeps saying, be careful, be careful. We need to take very seriously that we, the progressive, you know, critical, whatever we want to call ourselves, scholar activists, are part of the problem. And that we are the site of production of hegemony, and that we in a certain way contribute to the production of subalternity. Yeah? And that every time we speak and are heard, we are contributing to processes of silencing.
My question is explicitly for Howard Cagle. I tried to connect to something that Amin Hussein said earlier, especially with regard to Chile, which I think the situation today is probably the most unforeseen at the moment. So I think Germany probably still refuse it to see it. So there you have the situation that you have like this sort of modern neoliberal country falling into this massive unrest. Yet I think it was the president of Ecuador who was still advocating that we have to like follow Chile and its example, while there were 2 million people on the streets of Santiago, which is probably a quarter of the overall population of Chile. And so what I wanted to ask you is, doesn't this situation sort of challenges your idea of the aesthetic moment in resistance insofar as you can say that you need to be in a sort of good position like Extinction Rebellion to be able to do that I lost the word. And there's a certain point where you get like too dangerous for the government to like do that, and because you had these beautiful interventions like the philharmonics playing Pueblo Unido, Jamasera Vencido, with like a million people singing with it with them, or 1,000 guitars for Victor Jara, the famous poet, singer-songwriter who was tortured to death by the dictatorship. But on the same side, you have like massive police violence against protesters. On the one side, I mean, the Chilean police bypassed, sadly, the record of shooting out eyes with rubber bullets in like 2 weeks. The Israeli security forces in the West Bank. And on the same time, you had like people fighting literally block by block towards La Moneda. And so, to like, long story short, doesn't that sort of show that aesthetics only get you so far, and at a certain point, to really make the difference, you have to take the leap into risking everything and starting, you know, like the hard fight with power relations?
Yeah, I mean, it could be a very, very long answer, but it's one that is that involves kind of your conception of strategy. I believe it's very important to preserve the capacity to resist. You know, it's directly from Clausewitz, that you can't do that last step of risking everything. It's irresponsible to future generations. I'm kind of quite concerned about the Hong Kong situation now, because I believe in the Tiananmen Square event, we saw kind of the consequences for the capacity to resist of, you know, severe kind of repression. So in a sense, for me, kind of resistance movements have to have an exit for now, a means of tactical retreat in order to maintain their strategic capacity to resist. And aesthetic kind of forms kind of provide that, particularly with the with the pink boat, for example, that it was clear that, you know, the withdrawal of that kind of meant, you know, an invitation to de-escalate. If there is not the, if there is no means of de-escalating, if there is a complete, risk that's taken, then there is, there's a possibility of success, but then there has also to be the responsibility for failure, which is not just for now, but for generations to come. I don't know what you guys feel about that.
Yeah. I just would like also to say something here, because I think it's so interesting how we shifted now to from starting with a participatory art practice with Bruguera now, where I would say, and we put it into the middle of the presentation, that her concept of arte utile has a different kind of, I would say, frame, because it goes also into the point that you want to to create a space, but also to work with the people to continue a way, like, or to continue their way, whatever they want them to do, rather than some, I perhaps a bit provocative now towards what's was discussed here now, telling people what to do. So I don't know, this kind of position. Now I felt like we could see now this kind of differences as well, and it's interesting for me how much what started as an art project, a social practice in art, turns now towards towards a political fight or towards a rebellion in a way. So I was wondering now, like, I'm trying to think how we ended up here, but I, trying to bring us back again to, yeah, to the point.
Can I just give a very quick response? It's not
please.
A very well-thought response, but of course it's definitely a good idea, instead of this patronizing attitude of telling people what to do, asking them what they want. But of course there's a presumption there that people know what they want, and that they can transparently communicate to you what they want, as if that's possible. You can ask the subaltern what the subaltern desires, and then the subaltern can transparently communicate that to you.
So you would say that
I would say that that's a huge ideological maneuver.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Yes. And here we have two speakers. Yes.
Does anybody in this room know what they want? That would be the end of psychoanalysis. Wow.
It's nice. Right?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Okay, I want to introduce myself by name. My name is Professor Evelyn Goodman-Tau. I very much hesitated whether I should at this point jump in, but since your last remark, I think it's important. This morning, I want to say in two sentences my biography. I was born in Vienna, survived the war in Holland, live in Israel since 1956, have a family, etc., and work in Germany since 1985, teach in Germany. The reason why I teach in Germany, because I didn't want the next generation forever to remember Judaism or the Jewish tradition in Europe only under perpetrators and victims and Shoah and anti-Semitism. Okay. I'm also of the opinion that at this moment, as we had the historical Streit, we now have the anti-Semitism Streit. Okay, because of State of Israel. Now, everybody knows that Jews never had political power and political whatever. Now, one of the reasons, I think, why at the very beginning of my statement this morning, I said something about aesthetics and ethics. I have one son who is an artist, actually two sons. They're both artists. One is artist Marquet and the other one is artist, is an architect, is now in Los Angeles. Since a couple of years. I very much feel that one of the reasons why we are in this conversation is because we are in a transition. We are in a transition where, on the one hand, nation states were established because of certain religious convictions, Christian, Muslim, or Jewish. And because we are in a transition, I think that aesthetics, now I want to see it from the other side, aesthetics has a very, very important role to play. I also teach a lot of Hannah Arendt, etc. Has a very important role to play. I think every person in this room has certain political positions. We also know that the media are telling us fake news and all kinds of things, and sometimes they're saying these are bombing first and these are bombing second. I know that my grandchildren are sitting also under rockets. But what is most important is the following, that we say we are part of the problem and we are outside of the problem. That means people who are not in the situation themselves have the privilege and the freedom to speak out. You understand? And I think this position we should cherish every single day, because we are free and we're not occupied, but we are in certain situations occupiers. Now, here is a challenge for artists. Here is a challenge for us as teachers, political scientists, philosophers, to allow this special position of geography, of religion, of conviction and all that, and then to know there is no one who bears more responsibility than me to take responsibility. And I think this is one of the problems, that we don't always are ready to take responsibility and pay a price for this moment where we took responsibility. Thank you.
Is this already on? Do I need to push something? No, you can hear me? Okay, good. So, first of all, thank you for your talks, which were all really just focused the mind in very different ways and will require a while to digest. And we just heard the question, do we know what we want? And that's one of the things that I want to pick up on what I heard in your talks, beginning with the last one. So you framed your activism with two mottos, fuck Kant, and at the end, fuck the police. And in the equivalence, that creates a very interesting parallel. And especially when we combine it with the other talks, where you drew our attention and remind us of this intellectual tradition that then, especially with Kant, in the way in which the Königsberg Enlightenment was formulated, is hosted in the very country in which the Holocaust can then occur.
how is that possible? And then you bring this amazing set of aesthetic strategies that which you combine with Clausewitz, who's one of the fabulous readers of Kant. And in addition, you've produced amazing work on Kant. And so Kantian philosophy is something that you've thought deeply about. And if we could just sort of, at that level, try to think of what are the commonalities and differences in this source code that is so important for thinking the aesthetic, thinking the moral, thinking our cognitive options. And now I've heard three talks which were amazing and seem to take completely different positions on this potential.
But do you have a suggestion for this? Because this is like a very difficult like request now to come up with. Yeah, do you have an idea?
Well, I think each.
Oh, it just
we're having
the
a panel discussion.
Solution is like to keep it as it is, like each voice stands and.
To focus the conversation on that particular point of commonality and difference, which was implicit, but I would like to hear it made explicit in terms of these positions. Well, one of them was very explicit, but so punctuated that maybe you have more to say. And yes, so that's the invitation.
I'd like to respond to it because it's something that I'm struggling with at the moment. So fuck Kant is a very, very, I mean, tempting, what do you call it, suggestion. As a philosopher, that's an erotic dream come true. Although I don't think he was particularly into women as far as I know his sexuality. So Spivak has this conversation on what is enlightenment, and there she talks about what went wrong with enlightenment. Mm-hmm. She talks about the wonderful promise, and this is a word that we've heard very often today, promise of enlightenment, these emancipatory ideas of freedom, equality, liberty, rule of law, democracy, human rights, justice. And she uses a very powerful metaphor to describe the relationship of post-colonialism to European enlightenment. And she uses the metaphor of child of a rape. So the legacies of enlightenment, and Kant somehow embodies, particularly German enlightenment. In fact, I mean, before I go into explaining the child of a rape, it's quite interesting to note that right now there's a very controversial debate that's happening around 18th century political thought. Students of, for example, Shaila Ben Habib, Shankar Muthu wrote this book called Empire Against Enlightenment Against Empire, arguing that particularly German enlightenment was anti-empire. So he basically makes Kant into Che Guevara of political theory and says, you know, if you read early Kant, yeah, he was, you know, racist, and his whole lectures, anthropology, geography lectures, yeah, they tend to be racist. But if you read later Kant, so Ewig und Frieden, Perpetual Peace, his idea of Weltbürgertum, he's warning Europeans that, you know, colonialism not only dehumanizes the natives, it also dehumanizes Europeans. Yeah, so he's constantly talking about how it's bad for trade, but it's not just bad for trade, it's also not good. He uses the concept of cultural diversity, so they give examples of German enlightenment to show actually that anti-colonial thinking should not just draw on, you know, when we're talking about Fanon or Césaire, they usually tend to draw on Hegel and Marx, 19th century philosophy, but actually we should draw on Kant, because Hegel and Marx were actually defenders of empire. Marx, for example, says, yeah, we know what the British are doing in India is terrible, but it'll facilitate the transition from feudalism into capitalism into communism, so it's a necessary evil. Whereas Kant does not justify empire. So this is new scholarship in 18th century political thought, which is actually, to repeat myself because it's such a wonderful punchline, making Kant into Che Guevara of political theory. Spivak notes that, but says that, you know, our relationship, and this is a term that was used earlier during the day, is we're caught in a double bind. We are, it's a very, very ambivalent relationship, and then comes the metaphor of child of a rape. So it's it's tempting, and I'm using, again, strong language, to abort the child of the rape and say, fuck Kant. In not the erotic sense of fuck Kant, but move away from Kant. We don't read Kant, Hegel, Marx, dead white men who justify and defend empire. And she says, instead of that, the challenge is, how do you learn to love the child of a rape? How do you, and we, another term that was used, self-sabotage. Yeah, she uses the term sabotage, but adds affirmative in front of it and talks about the affirmative sabotage of the Enlightenment. Now, sabotage was, I'm sorry I'm giving a long answer, but I'm being paid right now by the Volkswagen Stiftung precisely to do this research. So it's called a critical theory of postcolonialism. I'm very good at marketing myself, so here goes. It's a book that's work in progress, so this is a little appetizer of what I'm... So thank you for the question. You'll get a commission. Very quickly. The sabotage was a strategy used by the anarchists, recognized strategy by the anarchists. So there was boycott, there was strike. And they said, it's one strategy is not to turn up for work. Yeah? That's how you make the capitalist vulnerable. Don't turn up for work. Production stops, capitalism is vulnerable. Another strategy is to turn up for work. Come to work and then sabotage the machinery. So there was a phrase that was used by the Scottish dock workers called go canny, go slow. Work slower than so that you that the exploitative wages that you've paid become fair wages. Because you don't work as efficiently so that the capitalist does not draw that much profit from your exploitative labor. Spivak uses this anarchist strategy and adds an affirmative in front of it and kind of revisits, and now my last sentence, Audre Lorde's assertion that you can't use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. And she says, perhaps we need to be creative in our instrumentalization of the master's tools to dismantle the master's house.
You want me to say something about Kant? Yeah, I think Kant is complicated. And you know, really following on from your points, the essay, you know, answering the question, what is enlightenment, is published in the magazine of a secret society. So you know, Kant, on the one hand, is willing to participate in creating an illusion of enlightenment while actually you know, using or being complicit with the exercise of power, you know, unenlightened power, in order to maintain the enlightenment after the death or the feared death of Frederick II. It's also very interesting, I think, to relate him to Clausewitz, because in many ways, kind of Clausewitz is one of the most faithful readers of Kant. He's the only, you know, he's the only philosopher after Kant who had a direct connection kind of with him pedagogically. So his teacher was Chiesa-Vetta, who was a kind of popularizer of Kant with Kant's approval. And what's extraordinary about Clausewitz is that there is no concept of freedom. So this is a Kantianism without freedom. It's a Kantianism of actuality, which is about, you know, with what Clausewitz does, is to say actuality is war. And that we are, you know, we are in a state of war. You know, that is that, you know, that is the default state, and we may alleviate that by thinking that there's also politics, or kind of art. But at bottom, you know, we're at war, and being at war, we have to think strategically and tactically. So that, in a way, is one of the legacies of Kant. It's not the main one, which is the rhetorical one of Fichte, Hegel, later Marx. You know, that is, this is about freedom and, you know, somehow actualizing freedom. It's a much kind of more somber kind of view of actuality, which I think has better political lessons. I don't think we should let that Kant go too easily.
Oh, it's off already? No, we're still here. So I would like to, besides, if it's okay, like I would like to close it up with this nice answers now.
It was a very, very long, intense day for all of us. And as you said already, I think it gave us a lot of food for the brain to think. And I hope it inspired you a little bit also to continue to think, and even though it is a slow process. And I would like to thank you all for coming here, and thank everyone who helped us make this experiment possible, because it was an experiment. And it was, at the end of the day, for me also very interesting how every one of you reacted on the invitation or not, I have to say, or not. But it's okay. You know, that's the experiment, and that's what we try to see, what happens if we invite you and what you pick out of it. So I'm thank you all for this, and wish you a very nice, relaxing evening. Thank you.